am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today we'll talk with William Luvaz, whose journey as a writer has been the journey of his life. He's been an NEA grant recipient and has been recognized for his short stories and novels alike. He has just published his third novel, Beneath the Coyote Hills, marked by the author's gift for language and his observations of the effects of wealth and culture on our human condition. We'll also listen to singer-songwriters Robbie Hecht, Aaron Joseph Pusey, and Eliza Gilkison. Stay with us. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. William Luvaz is a writer who is attracted to outsiders, folks who live on the edge and face the challenges of life in the context of difference. He explores our changing climate, socially and environmentally, and doesn't shy away from bending reality in his fiction. His novels include The Seductions of Natalie Bach and Going Under, and his short story collections are the story cycle Ashes Rain Down and A Working Man's Apocrypha. Bill's work can be found in many, many literary publications, and his latest novel is Beneath the Coyote Hills. Set in the high desert of Southern California, the novel explores the forces of choice and chance and success and failure, with poetic prose and a narrative structure that leaves you wondering about the nature of reality itself. Here is our conversation. William Luvaz, so happy to be talking to you today about your latest book, Beneath the Coyote Hills. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This book is, it's complex in its structure. It's the story of a man, Tommy, who is also an author, and the structure of the book has parallel storylines going on with Tommy and his life, and Volt, and who may be somewhat of Tommy's alter ego.
Mm-hmm.
And as the book progresses, that relationship of author to his story cyclones into what almost bridges on a little bit of magic realism in my mind, but almost as a reflection of the character. And I'd love you to talk about that, about the structure of the book and how you went about that and your intent and how you moved through it.
I really had no idea at all when I started this work that it would do this, that it would become this complex. I started with the character Tommy, and he is, well, one might say homeless, except that he's built himself a little home in an abandoned olive grove in Southern California. I was thinking kind of Riverside County. It's pretty arid. And so I started with him, and he just barely is making it. As he says, you know, capitalism produces a lot of trash, and he kind of lives off of that. But he's to kind of, as he says, to keep himself sane, he writes. And actually, he had a pretty good start as a writer because he went to, he was a Stegner Fellow at Stanford, but then he decided he didn't like that, and he kind of gave it up for a time. So he's writing a book. He starts writing a book about V.C. Hofstadter, Volt is his nickname. And he is kind of an alter ego. He's a very successful, very wealthy man. He has a kind of a business empire. And he's successful in everything he does, whereas Tommy has a very rough time in life. He has nothing, it seems, but bad luck, and then he's an epileptic, so he has seizures, which he can't control. I've always been interested in this idea of how much we control and how much we don't in our lives. We Americans, I think, like to think that we are in control, that character is fate, and I've never really bought that. Lots of things will determine our fate, bad luck, you know, ailments or whatever. So he starts writing about Volt, and the two stories are intertwined, and then we jump back into the past in Tommy's life, which is somewhat related to his epilepsy because, especially with temporal lobe epileptics, there can be a confusion of past and present. One can come out of a seizure not sure where they are in time, and I wanted to play with that. But so there's that element, too, in terms of the plot and the complexity of the work. But as time goes on, the story of the two parallel stories of Volt and Tommy are developing, and then we start seeing that this fellow Hofstadter doesn't just seem to be in this novel Tommy's writing. He actually seems to be in his life. He stepped out of the novel and is impacting Tommy's life. He owns a company that Tommy works for, and he fires him. He owns the mortgage company, that mortgage originator that Tommy gets his house loan from. And, of course, when there's the crash of 07-08, the house is foreclosed upon. And so he actually steps out of the pages of Tommy's novel and begins to take over my novel. And that's almost what it felt like as I was writing it. The two become mixed up, confused. I love that. There's a real element of magic realism. I suppose I was first introduced to the idea with Mario Vargas Llosa's Aunt Julian, the scriptwriter, in which a radio announcer who's making up these stories, the stories invade the narrative and begin to take over. So that's kind of where it started and where it went. And there's another element we finally find towards the very end that actually neither Tommy nor Hofstadter, Hofstadter may not be a product at all of Tommy's writing, but both he and Tommy may be the inventions of yet another writer who is Volt's wife, who has written a novel called Under the Hollow Sky, which seems to be about a character like Tommy, a guy down in his luck. And so it gets a little complex.
It kind of turns back on itself, and the stories become conflated. And I couldn't help but to think that, again, that you are commenting on the notion of who's in control,
right,
and on what level. And I thought throughout the book, Tommy calls himself and people call him a fitster because of these seizures he has. But also, I think it was interesting how you're commenting that we are not in control of our family lives, our parents, that themselves are disturbed and troubled, and that, in fact, I think at one point one of the characters says to Tommy that, you know, this doesn't have to do with your parents. It has to do with you, though. Mm-hmm. Tommy's father plays a big role in the book on a couple of different levels and in a couple of different incarnations. And so I wonder if you could talk about that in terms of the book, but also just in terms of who we are, because it seems like that's a big part of what you're exploring.
Yes, it is. Yeah, Tommy's father is very disapproving, as fathers sometimes can be. He's actually rather appalled by, disgusted by Tommy's fits, or as he calls them, spells, his seizural activity. He never really... I've always kind of felt that our parents, I mean, this is not original thought by any means, but our parents never really leave us. They become a part of us, very much a part of our emotional selves. And that's very true of Tommy. His father, although he dies, or we're told he dies,
we learned
that in the narrative, but to Tommy, he doesn't die. He actually appears before him in the flesh years after his childhood. He's a grown man. His father's supposed to be dead. He's not dead to him. And he has he seems to almost trigger Tommy's seizures at times. Now, for epileptics, and I might as well just admit I have epilepsy myself. It's not something we easily own up to, because it's written, a lot of people have some very strong negative feelings about it. But sometimes a problem you've had, an emotional problem with a parent or with someone else, a spouse, can actually help to trigger a seizure. You feel it does. I know Van Gogh talked a good bit about this. Dostoevsky does. So that's what's happening in Tommy. And in terms of control of things, when you have an ailment like this, you have no say in when something hits you, a spell, a fit, a seizure, whatever you want to call it, no control at all. It just comes out of the blue, and it's called the falling sickness. So that's informed me very strongly, not just in my work, but in my life. And I'm actually troubled a bit that we Americans so hold ourselves up to this standard of needing to control everything. So if you get cancer, it's your fault. You've done something wrong. If you're mentally ill, well, it's your fault. What's wrong with you? Why don't you get your act together? And yet every one of us has difficulties that we have no control over, and the question then becomes, how do we deal with them? Can we get up again after being knocked down? And that's something that's of great interest to me.
I felt the book brings up a lot of issues about that lack of control, that even in a relationship where you may have a commitment and even children, we still don't always have control of situations and outcomes. And it seems like Tommy in the book, this is something he's moving through too, his own relationship with the people around him and levels of trust and levels of betrayal. And I think sometimes it all takes him a little bit by surprise. Mm. But sometimes not, because maybe he himself has been victimized by others in a way. And so I found that interesting, his relationship with the women in his life.
Mm-hmm. He's had two failed marriages, and they were just radically different temperaments, and his wife had a lot of trouble with his epilepsy. She didn't even know he was an epileptic until he has a seizure out at dinner one night. And his second wife, and they have a child who dies actually of cancer, and then they have a little girl. And That is a very difficult relationship, too. And he finally, when he's in the midst of all this trouble, being foreclosed on his house, his son dying of cancer at Sloan Kettering in New York, and the tremendous economic burden of that, he kind of loses it, and he leaves. He abandons his family in the end, very troubled by doing so, but feeling he just can't handle it. And then he does meet a woman when he's out in his olive grove, a woman named Cleopatra, who's kind of queen of the highway. She's a, you know, some of our characters we become fond of. I'm quite fond of Cleopatra.
Yes.
And she's a very beautiful woman, but she kind of comes and goes in his life. She doesn't want a commitment. But yes, I think in relationships too, and I think this is very true of a lot of my work, nothing is, well, they just take a lot of work. And sometimes people will drift apart through no fault of either one's, and sometimes they're are irreconcilable differences, and then that interest, it just kind of fits into the whole mix of his difficulties with people and with his experience in life, that it's all of a piece somehow.
And just all of the things you brought up of the mortgage crisis and him getting caught up in that, and mm-hmm. and him being let go of from certain jobs and everything, really does reflect a reality, our cultural reality, that is even going on right now. So I felt that there's something to relate to. And in fact, I even thought there was, I didn't know if this was really how you intended it, but I also felt there was a little bit of Trumpism in, mm-hmm. in here, you know, when failure is America's
That's
true
right.
F word, and losers, it's bad to be a loser. And I don't know if you, when you were writing that, you were thinking of that, but it just struck me how, wow, that is exactly what is being promoted by Donald Trump right now as
right,
the presidential
sure
candidate.
And you can imagine what I must think of Donald Trump in terms of this book. Am I just thinking in general? But, well, it's curious, you know. Trump wasn't running for president when I started this. Of course, I knew about Trump, and maybe he was kind of in the back of my mind. I was thinking about a Trump-type character, but there are a lot of those. I also think about T. Boone Pickens or Carl Icahn or a lot of these sorts who are very powerful, very rich, and very full of themselves. And, of course, it's reached the point now where it's just kind of obnoxious madness. But I think it does grow out of this notion that, yeah, they're winners and losers. I don't know if I've ever met a pure winner or loser in my life. I don't know if many of us have, but there we go. We stick ourselves with that.
Yes, yes. And Tommy is more of what I would call almost a counterculture character, or maybe even a hero in a certain way, in his disassembling the remains of that housing bust, and literally taking fragments of houses that were vacated by others or that people were mm-hmm. evicted from, and making his own home and his own reality. And at one point, he even talks about he could even envision having a business of just canning things that were discarded from the grocery mm-hmm. store and reselling them. So that, to me, represents a worldview that maybe is one of yours.
Yeah, well, it is. I wouldn't say I was homeless, but I actually lived out in the Redwood Forest in Northern California in a little shelter I built in a burned-out redwood stump, a kind of, almost like a little log cabin of sorts. And there were a number of people living out there, some of whom built just remarkable places. One guy wanted to, they were tearing down a hotel in Fort Bragg, which was nearby. And so he borrowed someone's pickup or something. He brought back pieces of this hotel, you know, beams, floor joists, and he was trying to reconstruct the hotel in the treetops, about 40 feet up off the ground. And we called him Crazy Edward because I think he was quite out of his mind in some ways, also very brilliant fellow. Years later, I learned he had some role in the writing of Hair, which was quite amazing. So I had a little experience of that. I was very impressed by a number of the people I ran into who were just living completely off the grid, just completely outside of society, building their own life, their own. And I kind of have done that to some extent in my own life. My wife and I both have kind of see things as, well, I never really wanted to fit in completely, wanted to sort of do it in my own terms. And you know, if you want to be a writer, an artist, it's tough. And I think we decide fairly early on, well, you got to put your work first, as a good friend advised me when I was just starting out. And okay, just pick up some work. And finally got into teaching college, but it took me many years to get there. I wanted something more stable. But, I was actually fascinated writing the book, thinking, okay, well, how do you make it out in living in this semi-arid place, and you have no income coming in? And so he goes to dumpsters and nearby grocery stores. He picks out, he says they throw away a lot of cereal, which they do, and a lot of fruit that's just starting to rot, and vegetables, and he takes them back to his place and he cans some of them. And yeah, he's thinking, well, one could just start a business and do this, just using the trash, things thrown away by the society.
I'm talking with William LaVos on his latest novel, Beneath the Coyote Hills. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. We'll return to our conversation in a couple of minutes. I want to take a short break with Robbie Hecht, an emerging singer-songwriter based in Nashville. With a distinct and individual style, Hecht expresses what has been called a delicate audacity. You know, we're a show about books and writers, but that's why occasionally I like to bring great songwriting to you, especially when it's delivered with such melodic ease. Robbie Hecht has released 4 CDs to date, and this is Hard Times from his 2014 self-titled album. Now here is Robbie Hecht.
There was a camp town man, used to plow and sing. He loved that mule, and the mule loved him. And when the day got long, as it does about now, I'd hear him sing to his muley cow. Come on, sweet old girl, I bet the whole damn world we're gonna make it, yeah, to the end of the road, singing hard times. Oh, time. seems to mean no world, heavy in me. That big machine is just picking up speed. Yeah, they were supping on tears, they were supping on wine. We all get to heaven in our own sweet time. So come on, all ye Asheville boys, turn up your old time noise. Kick till the dust comes up from the cracks in. Camptown man, he doesn't plow no more. I seen him walking down to the cigarette store. I guess he lost that night, he forgot that song. Woke up one morning and his mule was gone. So come on, you ragtime kings, come on, you dogs and sing. Pick up the dusty old horn and give it.
That was Hard Times from Robbie Hecht and his self-titled album, Robbie Hecht. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Let's get back to my conversation with author William LaVosse on his novel, Beneath the Coyote Hills. LaVosse is an NEA fellow, has taught writing at San Diego State and the University of California, Riverside, and is the online editor of Cutthroat, a journal of the arts. We're talking about the main character of the novel, Tommy Aristophanos, an epileptic fiction writer who is haunted by visions and makes his way in the world, living off what is discarded by others. I felt that his genius, if you want to call it, because he was an intelligent person that was maybe undermined somewhat by his circumstances, but his drive was irrepressible in a way. And there were a lot of other characters. When you were just talking about your own experience, there were a lot of characters in Tommy's life that were also living on the edge, and there was a lot of brutality, and it takes a lot of wiles and a strong network to survive that kind of brutality. And one of his strong relationships is with a character called Crash. Mm-hmm. And Crash himself has an outlook on life that astounds Tommy. And at one point, Crash says, "It's all good, bro." Mm-hmm. And Tommy is kind of amazed, and he's talking about Crash saying, "Missing an arm, living on SSI with a mentally disabled son, and it's all good? Impressive." Mm-hmm. Yet that was the truth of that person. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about still having a heart and strength, as Cleo did, I think, despite the adversity and the knocks that you get.
Yeah, and Cleo at one point was captured by some strange, crazy, perverse people and held in a cabin and sexually abused for a period of time until she escaped. But Crash is, I think Faulkner said writers are immoral and that they will beg, borrow, and steal whenever they can. And I suppose I did that a bit with Crash. I know a fellow at a gym I go to out in Riverside County who... Yeah, it's very much like Crash. He was missing an arm. He had tattoos all over his body, and they were telling stories. He had become a born-again Christian. And so there would be things that have to do with his religious awakening, some of the tattoos. One of the tattoos was literally of a guy flying off a motorcycle, which was in flames. That was one of his many accidents. I think he had lost his arm in a motorcycle accident. And he said, "I've broken every bone in my body at least twice." Well, usually you think that's nonsense, but not with this guy. And so he comes back to life in Crash. And actually this fellow said to me one day, the fellow I actually know at the gym, he had an interesting way of doing certain exercises. He would kneel on the floor as if he was praying and pull these weights down towards himself on a certain machine. And he had a special device he used on the missing arm, a kind of hook that he would use to help him. And he just looked up at me, and I knew he was having some problems with his son. He was trying to get him into an institution. He had no money, and So we'd been talking a little about that, and he looked up at me, and he kind of smiled, and he said, "But you know, it's all good, bro." And it just knocked me out, as it knocks Tommy out. How is that possible? And yet, this was true as far as his character was concerned. He knew he'd had some sense of how bad things could be. He might have died in that motorcycle crash. And, if you make it through, if you're doing okay, life's good.
And it seems like that, and I don't want to give too much of the trajectory and the end of the novel away for our readers who might want to discover that themselves, but it does seem like Tommy's journey is a very difficult one, filled with lots of brutality and rejection. Yet there is community around him, and he has to acknowledge that he is. And I don't know that he puts it that way, but it does seem like that there is a community around him of people who are looking out for him, even if it wasn't the people that you might expect.
That's another thing I think that, as I see it anyway, is kind of an outgrowth of our culture with its fetish, its success-failure fetish. I think community has suffered tremendously because of that. I was so impressed. I lived for a while in England where people actually talked about that. Well, you Yanks, you know, you're so much into making your lists of who's the best at this or the best at that. And there was a lot of community there. There was real friendship. People valued friendship so much, at least in my experience. I think we're sorely missing that. People will go to religion to find their fellowship, or there are not too many places to go when you think about it. I mean, you can hang out at the local coffee shop. People hang out on, they do the social networking, but is that really community?
Right.
People going to be there for you when you're sick? He just happens, these folks, because they're, none of them are doing too well, kind of rely on each other to some extent, and it is an important motif. People have pointed out to me, and sometimes actually, as strange as this may sound, it's kind of surprised me, well, you know, you're really into community in your work. It's not just conflict. You want to write as well as about people coming together, kind of the opposite of conflict. Maybe because, I think it was Andre Brink who said, we write about doors we can't go through. Well, I would love to see more community, just in general, and it's not so easy to find. Some very fortunate people have it, but I think we suffer greatly because we can't share with other people many of the things we'd like to share.
Yes. Now, this book is set down in kind of the high desert of Southern California, San Bernardino area. I mean, as I was reading it, I could almost picture that part of California that even it seems around maybe Victor or something. And you live down in that area. Is that right?
Yes. We live for, quite a while, about 15 years out in Riverside County in a place called Hemet. Which is a very relatively poor town. It's right at the foot of the San Jacinto Mountains. It's dry there, although Hemet, relative to some places around, is a paradise because they have water off the mountain. And it used to be a great, an agricultural, very, very prosperous agricultural community, but most of that's died out now. And it raises houses, not crops. But it's very hot in the summer. And the sun is so intense that you almost can't be out in it midday. So it's so impressive to watch these folks working out in the fields around, or the construction workers roofing a house when it's 112 degrees out and the sun's beating down and there's almost no humidity whatsoever. So it's kind of a tough place in that sense. But, you know, strangely enough, even though I'm from Oregon and spent many years in Northern California and New York and other places that are much cooler and much moister, I kind of come to have a great affection for these arid zones. They have their own kind of beauty. The sun hitting the mountains or the hills in late afternoon, especially in the fall, is so dramatic, it's quite moving in a way. How it turns different colors, you know, one part of the hill facing the sun will just be bright glowing yellow, and another part in a canyon or something will be almost blue. So I've been very taken, and I find myself I've set a couple novels there, actually three novels, and just a whole lot of short stories in an area that I never imagined I would ever be writing about years ago.
When I go down there, it's always been a challenging landscape, as you described, to be in it, but also how the... as you said, they grow houses now, and the encroaching development, human development, into these very textural landscapes, sometimes it's just anachronistic in a way.
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
And I recall, though, seeing a community of homes that was almost how you were describing it in the book of, well, there was nobody living there, mm-hmm. and it was like a little community, but there was nobody in it. And so when I was reading that in the book, it was very vivid to me. So what do we have coming up from you? It seems like you are a very busy writer with a lot of short stories. You have another novel coming out?
I do. I have a novel coming out next year, probably next summer. We haven't set a date for certain. It's also set in an area much like the area Tommy is living in, maybe just a little lusher, but it's called Welcome to St. Angel, St. Angel being the town. It's about a community of people who are fighting development, trying to stop it. And they're a very zany bunch. I can't help myself. My characters are going to be zany no matter what I do. And they're kind of outsiders, and they're very much sort of self-made people. But there's a group of wealthy developers that actually they all know each other. And so there gets to be a split between the well-off and the not-so-well-off in the community. And they're literally destroying the landscape with the developments. They're just going in, knocking, they're just bulldozing everything up. And they're also taking all the water, the precious underground water supply from the aquifer. The big developers are putting in huge, very deep wells, and they're literally drying up the wells of the people who've lived there for years and who love it, who very much love the place. So I suppose I'm really concerned about the issue of development. I'm very concerned about global warming, which fit very prominently in my last collection of stories, Ashes Rain Down. And I just find myself going back to that again and again. So that novel's forthcoming. And then I've started work on another book that's... Well, I've had to take a little hiatus here because a lot's going on, but that's an altogether different kind of thing about, it's about a relationship and which is has gone very bad, and the woman has to escape her husband because he's pretty brutal, not so much physically as psychologically. So she escapes with her son, and he's a very powerful guy. He's a deputy DA who's probably going to become the district attorney in Los Angeles, and so he has tremendous connections with law enforcement, and the question is, how do you escape someone like that? So I'm playing with that. It's kind of a different sort of a thing for me, but I'm enjoying it.
Well, it sounds like your work really does involve a lot of social and cultural observation.
I do think all writing is political to some extent, even though we may not have that much of an agenda, and we certainly don't want to be writing agitprop, but I do think, I think Joyce Carol Oates has made quite a point of that, that we are going to have some political commitment in our work because we're a political animal.
And we're alive on the planet, and when we see things around us, we're not doing ourselves a service if we don't talk about them. You know, I want to thank you. Your current book that we've been primarily talking about is Beneath the Coyote Hills. I hope if you're up in this part of California that you'll come visit us.
I certainly will, yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And is there anything else you feel like we didn't cover that maybe you want our listeners to know about?
Well, we covered a lot of territory. I just want to say to those people who may be listening, who are writers or wish to be writers, that I can tell you from experience that nothing matters more than just being persistent. Hang in there. Don't give up. Believe in your work, and just keep going. It's never a very easy ride for almost any of us. There are a few people who seem very just kind of, kissed by good fortune, but they're very few.
They are very few, and it's just doing the work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you for that, and all the best to you.
Thanks, Suzanne.
We've been listening to my conversation with William Luvas, and his recent novel is Beneath the Coyote Hills. Thanks, Bill. Thank you for listening today. I am Suzanne Lang. This is A Novel Idea, and you can hear me on the first Sunday of every month at 4, and sometimes on the fifth Sunday as well. I'd like to go out with a couple of singer-songwriters. We'll start with Aaron Joseph Pusey, whose self-titled EP contains this song, Old Friend, followed by an old friend to many of us, Eliza Gilkison, and Once I Had a Home, from her album, Roses at the End of Time.
There's a famine that is spreading, and there ain't no end in sight. And if you feel it closing in, don't go towards the light. I took a job in Big Spring, left my home up north, working in the same fields my pa worked as a boy. They say oil is the thing that'll fill your for gold, but what's the joy in riches when the wasteland is your home? Forgiveness will sustain you, the dollars will provide, but there ain't no use in running from your conscience you can't hide. Just like sorry's just a word, nothing's ever done, and love is just a fairy tale if you never find someone. And I see lightning in the distance, and there's oil on my hands, but I'll soon leave this living and give you all I have. Let's make up for time that wasn't so well spent. Let's make up love that's gone and won't be here again. There's a girl back in El Paso dreaming of me tonight, and California dreams a dream, the desert calls a lie. Go ahead, drive through western Texas, and then you just might know how it really feels to truly be alone. Oh, but I won't go back to Clovis and hear the coyotes cry, the place where I was born and where my brother Taylor died. Now the famine keeps on spreading, but I'm leaving here tonight. I'll be back home in El Paso before the morning's light. But sweet Jesus, won't you guide me? I can't see through the rain, for you are far back evil, so won't you help me shake the pain? Now I told that coward Satan, you'd best hide when I come back. We both met when we were kids, but only I became a man. And it's good to see you again. It's good to see you, my old friend. Let's make up for time that wasn't so well spent.
We've just heard Eliza Gilkison and Once I Had a Home from her album Roses at the End of Time, and before that, Old Friend from Aaron Joseph Pusey. I'm Suzanne Lang. We've had production help from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. You can listen to us online at krcb.org. Subscribe to our podcasts and listen anytime. Thanks for listening.